You're listening live to the fifth official episode of the Arman and Akil Show, bringing you interviews with local activists, politicians, and policy experts from Vancouver and the Lower Mainland. I'm Arman Rana. It's Saturday, the 17th of June, 2023, at 5:03 p.m. We are broadcasting live from UBC's Vancouver campus on the ancestral, traditional, and unceded territories of the Hankamenam-speaking Musqueam people. Today is a special science and technology episode where I'll be breaking down some of the latest events in science and technology, from space exploration to AI. Unfortunately, my co-host Akil is in India. However, I will be ably assisted by a pair of young professionals in the Vancouver technology space. They're also friends of mine from college. So we're going to be playing some clips and discuss the question that is on everybody's mind these days, which is, when are we getting our AI space utopia? So first, we have Horace Yu. Horace is a technology and management consultant with a deep interest in the space of AI. And next to him in the studio with me is Ash Kamble. Ash is an expert in developing plasma coding equipment that is used in, amongst other things, coding aerospace equipment to withstand extremely high temperatures. I hope I did not misrepresent their career paths, but that's my understanding, at least. So Horace and Ash are also mechanical engineers, and as mentioned, they're friends of mine. So Horace, why don't you kick us off by telling our audience a bit more about yourself, especially how your interest in both consulting and AI evolved over time.
Sure, yeah. Thanks, Amar, for the introduction. Pleasure to be here. Well, first of all, like you said, I did mechanical engineering, mechatronics specialization at UBC, just as Ash. And after I graduated, I kind of realized I love technology, but at the same time, I love business as well. So that's how I transitioned from being an engineer into management consulting. But even in consulting space, my focus is basically entirely in technology. That being said, what I do day by day is really help businesses to figure out how can they use technology to make their kind of daily process better. And right now, I have a lot of focus on AI just because, for one, it's a field that I love. For two, is it really has a lot of potentials, even though we haven't, well, we've already seen quite a bit after ChatGPT, but I believe we're still in the infancy stage of AI, and there's still a lot of opportunity for the business to explore that and harness the power of that technology. So that's kind of how I basically transitioned from my technical background into what I do now.
And do you find it useful, your mechanical engineering background? Did you find that useful at all in terms of, because the technology you're talking about has got nothing to do with mechanical engineering, right? Or does it?
Barely. Well, it doesn't benefit, well, my degree, I guess it didn't benefit what I do directly, but it did give me the capability of, you know, figuring out what are the new things out there. So even though AI is not about gears or drivetrains, but those fundamental understanding of the technology, being able to figure out this basic concept really helps me to understand the new technology that's come into, you know, the AI field. That helps. That definitely helps.
Makes sense. So, Ash, could you give our audience a bit more color about your background, and maybe you could explain that coding business a bit better than I did, and, you know, why it's needed in aerospace equipment?
Yeah, for sure. First of all, thanks for having me, Arman. Pleasure to be here as well. So my background is in mechanical engineering. I realized, I guess, in second year onwards that I have a deep passion for mechanical design. And so when I was choosing a career path, really I was looking just for design, so not too specific on which industry at that stage. And I stumbled upon this job that I'm currently at 4 years ago. And it was quite interesting because the job portfolio pretty much required most of the skills that I had developed in university. And the equipment itself was, you know, like Arman tried to explain earlier, I design plasma torch equipment. So plasma torch, essentially, it sprays molten particles onto a part to form a protective coating. And that protective coating could be used for really anything. So Arman gave the example of a thermal barrier used in aerospace engines and vanes and pipes that need to withstand really high temperatures. But it could also be used for wear resistance or corrosion resistance. And so there's a wide range of applications. I could, I guess, touch more upon the aerospace sector. So the whole premise is, instead of making this part of the airplane out of a very exotic material that's probably expensive and difficult to manufacture, but it has these performance requirements, instead of making the entire part out of that, you can make the part out of a cheaper, easy to manufacture material, but just apply a plasma sprayed coating onto the surface that requires it.
So, before you go a bit further, what is plasma?
Yeah, great question. So plasma is the fourth state of matter.
I thought there were only three states.
So you start with a solid. A solid, if you heat it up, its particles will start jostling more, and it will turn into a liquid at its melting point. If you heat up a liquid more, it will start to boil, and it reaches a gas state. If you heat up a gas enough, electrons will start to get stripped apart from its atoms. And so a plasma is any substance that has a mixture of atoms, molecules, these are neutral substances, but also ions and electrons, with an overall charge of this substance being neutral, because you have the same number of negative electrons as you have positive ions, but it contains all these four different species, and that's what a plasma is.
Yeah, why, you said earlier that you stumbled upon this career. How does one stumble upon such a specialized career path?
Yeah, honestly, good question too. I was at my final year at university, and I was browsing through job postings. It was between exams because I had a long gap between two of my final exams. And I came across this posting, I forget where exactly, but I came about this job posting, and it was honestly nothing like I've seen in my even internships or applying to jobs in my final year. It was like the tasks required for this job and the skills required matched so closely to what I had. It's almost like a square.
So where did you develop these skills?
At university, yeah. So in the courses, so funny enough, many of us in engineering don't use the things that we've taught in classroom at the job, but this wasn't the case for this job.
I see.
But also from my student team experience, the design work, the teamwork, the leadership, all this played a role in me liking this job and applying and eventually getting it. Mm-hmm.
All right, well, thanks so much for the intro. After the break, we'll be diving deeper into some of the latest happenings in science and technology space, especially starting with space. If you're just tuning in, you're listening to the Arman and Akhil Show on CITR 101.9 FM. This is a special science and technology episode. See you after a quick break.
Love being caffeinated? And do you hate that greedy, soulless international conglomerates are succeeding in the cutthroat world of coffee? Sounds like local coffee roasters Trek Coffee is for you. Trek Coffee is 100% indigenous and military veteran owned and operated. Let's keep small businesses thriving. Stop by Sunshine Convenience on 4th, the Super Value on Commercial, or Grocery Checkout in the Nest to pick up some Trek coffee today.
Slice of Life Art and Gift Shop is Vancouver's choicest destination for one-of-a-kind, artist-made prints, posters, screen prints, riso prints, paintings, acrylic paintings, watercolor paintings, ceramic mugs, ceramic plates, ceramic bowls, ceramic pots, lapel pins, hats, toques, crochet bathing suits, jewelry, trinkets, knickknacks, hand-painted signs, curated thrift, and a bunch more stuff that won't fit in this designated block of airtime. Slice of Life Art and Gift Shop, located at 1636 Venables, just off Commercial, open 11 to 6, 6 days a week.
Ladies and gentlemen, it is Monday.
From 1 to 3 p.m.
Who is this guy? Does he have a name? Let me know where he's from. From parts unknown.
My name's Chris Horrific.
You always wanted his character to be bigger than life.
Ladies and gentlemen, it is without question the greatest sports and entertainment event of all time. Be a part of it, Monday.
From 1 to 3 p.m.
The Parts Unknown Show on 101.9 CITR. Sometimes cosmoses collide.
The Parts Unknown!
That was actually a great ad to segue us into the next topic. If you're just tuning in, you're listening to the Arman and Akhil Show on CITR 101.9 FM. We are speaking with our panel of engineering professionals, otherwise known as my friends from college, to Horace and Ash here in studio with me, to break down what's happening in the area of space exploration. So to kick off this discussion, Ash, I'm going to play this clip about some discovery of really old galaxies. Let's take a quick listen to that, if this works.
Space telescope just made a shocking discovery that's got scientists scratching their heads. It found massive galaxies from just 500 to 700 million years after the Big Bang. That's way too early, according to our current model of the universe. One is even bigger than the Milky Way, yet it formed billions of years sooner. This raises big questions about how galaxies form and evolve. Could the early universe have been more efficient, or are we missing something in our models? Stay tuned as we uncover more cosmic mysteries with the James Webb Space Telescope. The James Webb Space Telescope just made a shocking discovery that's got scientists scratching their heads. It found massive galaxies from just 500 to 700 million years after the Big Bang. That's way too early, according to our current model of the universe. One is even bigger than the Milky Way, yet it formed billions of years sooner. This raises big questions about how galaxies form and evolve. Could the early universe have been more efficient, or are we missing something in our models?
So yeah, I just played it twice because I think Ash was having some audio issues. So yeah, what's your reaction to that? How does that make you feel?
Yeah, it is on my YouTube feed these days. So the James Webb Space Telescope is really able to show us in much greater resolution what's out there in the cosmos. And so that video you played touched upon these galaxies that have formed at around maybe half a billion years after the Big Bang. And based on our current model, based on our understanding of how the universe works, we say, okay, after the Big Bang, it takes at least maybe half a billion years for particles to coalesce because of gravity.
Before you go into that, like, what is your, like, how do you think about the Big Bang? Like, what's your mental model that you use to think about it?
Yeah, well, the Big Bang, I can give you a brief history on it. So Einstein's theory of general relativity, one of the predictions of this theory is that the universe is expanding, and it's expanding at an accelerated rate. And so when they, I guess, designed the Hubble Space Telescope, which was the predecessor of this JWST, they observed that the universe is indeed accelerating and it's expanding. So if you wind the clock back, the natural conclusion you get to is that far back in time, the universe must be converging to a single point that will be very hot and dense. And that was coined, I think, by John Wheeler at the time. He called it the Big Bang. So it's not so much a bang as much as it's an expansion from a point in space.
Yeah. So then continue. Sorry, your explanation of, so how does that connect to these observations
from the JWST? Yeah. So right after the Big Bang, there's several stages which I'll skip for now, but I will mention it. It does take a fair bit of time, let's say 500 million years, okay, for matter to coalesce into stars, for gravity to work. Because before that, things were just hot and dense and things wouldn't coalesce. They would just expand. But when things start to cool down a little more...
Is it kind of like if I took a bunch of let's say leaves and threw them up in the sky, it takes time for them to kind of coalesce?
I suppose if the leaves are really hot and jostling, okay, then they would tend to separate.
Yeah.
But as they cool down, they won't probably come back together because they don't have enough mass.
Yeah.
But you can imagine galactic objects would eventually coalesce. And so the first things that would form are stars, based on our current model. And then when you have enough stars, and we're talking billions of stars, then you would form galaxies. And so from our current model, we think that galaxies like our Milky Way, let's say, would take several billion years to form. Let's say 4 billion years, for example. But what the JWST is showing is it has found galaxies that are formed just about, I wouldn't say formed, but these galaxies are emitting light that the telescope can detect. And based on that, they have deciphered, I guess, that these galaxies are formed about 500 million years after the Big Bang. So what that means for us is either our model of how galaxies form has to change, because clearly we thought it would take billions of years for galaxies to form, but they're forming 500 million years after the Big Bang. That's one possibility. But another possibility, and this one's maybe a bit more exotic, in that maybe they were formed before the Big Bang. Our understanding of the Big Bang may be incomplete. And the reason they say it's formed before the Big Bang, because let's say galaxies do take the billions of years to form, as per our current model. But if they are detected 500 million years after the Big Bang, then surely they must have originated before the Big Bang.
So that's just crazy to think about. So how when you're thinking about before the Big Bang, how do you feel about that? How do you think about it?
Yeah, how to think about it? Well, here's my take on it. I think just because we can put words of the English language together to form a question, what's before the Big Bang, that makes perfect sense in terms of English language, right? But in terms of the truth, it may not be the right question to ask. And I just think that we're not there yet intellectually to ask the right question when it comes to the Big Bang. So as meta as that sounds.
Yeah, that's interesting. And so... let's talk a bit more about this telescope. What's special about this? So you said it tells us about the early history of the universe. You mentioned the work you do. There's some you have this special protective coating. Would a telescope like this require, of course, some sort of protection? The plasma torches that you work on, would they be useful for creating for being applied to this sort of equipment?
Yeah, absolutely. You have this telescope that's in outer space that gets much higher amounts of radiation than it does right here, and so if it needs a protection against that, there are also some t- tiles on, I guess, if the telescope was to come back into our atmosphere, there's a lot of friction as it enters any atmosphere. And so to protect it against that friction, you need surfaces that can withstand that amount of heat. So that's another application. There were two parts to that question. Remind me what the first part was, please.
Yeah, well, just like the telescope itself, like it. Do you have any idea? I know you're not working actively in terms of telescope manufacturing, but do you have any idea what's special about this telescope?
Yeah. Well, first, thanks for that disclaimer. I'm no expert in telescopes. You can ask me about plasma torches.
Yeah.
But just curious about telescopes and the universe in general. So I can share what I know. And again, this may not be completely accurate. So the JWST, it is able to detect infrared radiation. And so the idea is we want to peer back as much as possible, as close as possible to the Big Bang. And we know that objects that had formed, galaxies that had formed close to the Big Bang, emitted really intense ultraviolet light. But the universe had expanded since then. And so this UV light has stretched over all these years to the point where at present date, that UV light is actually stretched to infrared. So that's one good thing about this telescope. It enables us to detect galaxies really close to the Big Bang. And the other benefit of infrared is that, well, it can pass through clouds, and it can pass through like things really close to us that may be blocked by clouds or dust. We can see through it because infrared can. Visible light cannot, but infrared can.
Interesting. Yeah, this is crazy, the idea of, you know, UV changing to getting stretched over time. It's it's hard to think about. If you're just tuning in, you're listening to the Arman and Akhil Show on CITR 101.9 FM. This is a special science and technology episode. We are breaking down some of the latest happenings in science and technology with Horace and Ash. And yeah, do stay tuned. We'll be talking a bit more about AI, which is everybody's favorite topic, I guess, these days. So after a quick ad break.
Old or New Testament?
I think the New Testament.
The question is, Pilate, remember Pilate from the New Testament?
What does Pilate? He fiddled while...
Yeah, no, well, just a minute. Let me ask the question, then you can give me the answer, okay? Did Pilate want Jesus to be crucified?
Pontius Pilate washed his hands of it.
So did he want him to be crucified?
Yeah.
No. No. No.
Well, tune in every Friday afternoon, 3:30 to the Night Watch Show on Sunday.
Well, find a good church. It'll help you.
Hey, I'm Sarah from Alien Boys, and you are listening to CITR 101.9 FM in Vancouver.
We just played Velvet Dinosaurs and their latest hit, Eating the Plate. Now, let's go to the phones and hear what you have to say. Go ahead, caller, you're on the line.
Master Dirty Red Scum! Take him in the teeth, Red Hats!
Really?
Kill!
That's really
kill! Bad. Kill! Filthy bastard commies! I hate him! I hate
okay,
him!
Okay, well, You know, maybe you should relax a little bit. You're listening to CITR 101.9 FM in Vancouver.
The
The Sweetgrass Clan is a volunteer-based coalition that provides safety, security, and essential resources to the most vulnerable members of the downtown Eastside community. In addition to providing food and safety, the Sweetgrass Clan also connects people with advocates for housing, mental health counseling, and drug and alcohol detox. The Sweetgrass Clan is always looking for new volunteers to support the downtown Eastside community and are able to offer volunteers grocery gift cards and bus tickets as honorariums. If you would like to offer your volunteer support to the Sweetgrass Clan, you can reach out via email at abfrontdoor.org or visit abfrontdoor.org.
You want to change the state of the world, but instead you keep buying material goods to satisfy whatever desire you have in that very moment? Me too. But now you can do both! Rock Shop and Community Thrift is a local vintage shop that fulfills your 1970s alt-chic fantasy while also supporting at-risk people through their compassionate and supportive work training program. All of their profits go to the PHS Community Services Society to support ongoing health care, harm reduction, and health promotion projects in Vancouver and Victoria. So stop by their two locations, Community Unisex on West Hastings or Community Frock Shop on Corral Street. And if you know any other local businesses that deserve recognition for their generous business practices or their contributions to the community, please DM us on Instagram at CITR and Discorder because we would love to spotlight them. Because hey, if you can't stop buying, you might as well start supporting.
What a great message for all of us with our materialist cravings. So if you're just tuning in, you're listening to the Armand and Akil Show on CITR 101.9 FM. And yeah, we're just talking about space exploration with Ash and Horace here. Horace had a question actually for Ash.
Yeah, so that was certainly a very interesting topic. And that kind of just made me curious of all this new development in space or all this new discoveries in space. Does that in any shape or form contribute to the discovery of, you know, unknown life forms in the space?
Yeah, that's the question, isn't it, that everyone's itching to know the answer to. To my knowledge, the short answer to that is no. However, I can take it on a slightly different path. Armand, stop me and hijack this train of thought as you desire. So because of the vastness of the universe, there are definitely going to be patches within the cosmos that have the same conditions required for life form to form. And so to the simple question of is there life elsewhere, I think likely yes, just from a probability standpoint. There's so many stars and galaxies in the universe. There's so many possible habitable zones. And given the right conditions, I'm sure there will be at least simple life forms. The real question we want to know is there a complex life form? Are there aliens that we can communicate with, intellectual life forms? And my take on that is there is none. I'd love to be proven otherwise. But the sheer sequence of events and luck that it takes for a life form to go from simple-celled organisms to a complex multicellular organisms like us is just incredibly, stupendously unlikely that we may just be the only intelligent life form in this vast darkness. So take what you will of that and yeah, pass it over to Armand right now.
Yeah, so I did find when I was trying to like just get some bit of background before the show, there were so many clickbait videos about, Neil deGrasse Tyson exposed, God exists, and it has like a picture of Jesus Christ overlaid with like stars in the galaxy and the JWST telescope, and also other ones which were like, you know, alien life forms discovered. So I do think there is an aspect, you know, at least in popular culture to, ask legitimate questions about alien life forms, but also to kind of harness this to expound really, a very select theory about the creation of the universe or whatever. And I think, I remember seeing one of the Neil deGrasse Tyson was asked about this, and he mentioned that the fact that, science doesn't know things is a good attribute to science that, you just keep discovering. So I just wanted to ask you, Ash, before, we shift gears a bit here, how do you, what makes you so interested in this area, in space and the cosmos and the Big Bang, and why do you find it interesting?
It's a good question. I am curious about it in general. I think innately, I don't know maybe how to verbalize this, but I am just quite curious, and I find it fascinating, and I just want to understand nature better in this. It's quite a mysterious place that we are in. We don't know the answers to so many questions, and I'm a curious soul, so I keep digging.
Yeah. Cool. So I guess shifting to AI space, I'm going to kick us off by playing an AI-generated clip. The audio was generated by Voice AI, which is an kind of online platform for generating AI voice. And the actual words were generated by Bing, which is, as we know, powered by ChatGPT. And I want to get your reaction to it. It's loading.
Hey, folks, Joe Biden here. You listen to Armand and Nicole show. They're smarter, funny, and honest. They talk about everything that matters. Don't miss it. It's a great show, man. God bless America.
Voice.ai.
It is certainly very interesting. But personally, my threshold of, hearing or watching all the AI generated content is quite high now because I've seen so many of them. And plus, I've made so many of them. So for the audience that's listening to this show right now, I think it would be even more impactful if we can put a AI generated video on this. So it'll be Joe Biden's voice with his facial expression.
Exactly.
Exactly, the whole thing.
Yeah.
So the crazy thing about this is not hard to make anymore. Clone someone's voice, coming up with an AI-generated speech, and make a AI-generated video, it's very accessible to everyone. And a lot of these algorithms, a lot of these programs are open source. So, which means you can make any content yourself, and plus getting an image of a famous people or getting a voice recording of someone is so easy these days. So it is actually, from that angle, it is actually quite scary to think about how easy someone can just take a picture of you and a recording of you and make a video of you however they like. So that's the aspect of where we need to manage the risk of, using AI or misuse of AI. But on the other hand, there are a lot of positive things as well.
So yeah, somebody potentially could take this very recording and use it to impersonate you in the future. But what are some of the positive things that you see that are coming out of the new explosion in AI?
Yeah, right. Quite a bit, actually. You see, there are a lot of AI tools coming out on a weekly basis. I think a good way of thinking about this, I'm still trying to find out if it's true or not, but a good way of thinking about this is internet in 95. So for anyone that's old enough to experience the internet in 95, obviously I didn't have that opportunity, but so I'm trying to find out from people who actually had experience this. So from what I've heard so far is this is just like, in 95 when internet was just, starting to being used by everyone, people are thinking, oh, this is such exciting new things, but what can I do with it? But on the other hand, there's a relatively small group of people who is really, really you know, interested in the space, and they actively try to come up with ways of, you know, figuring out how to use internet and apply that into various aspects of life and business. And that's what kind of the major force that drove internet to where it is at today. I think that's similar things for AI right now. So for example, ChatGPT, I believe pretty much everyone have probably used it at this point. And there are a lot of companies trying to make that at an enterprise level, so to help companies to come up with content.
Can you talk a bit more about ChatGPT? Like, I've used it myself.
Yeah.
But just, you know, for our audience, what makes it so much different than, you know, we've seen chatbots before. They're really annoying when you have to go and try and interact with your bank or telecom company. They send you in circles with the chatbot. So what's different about mm-hmm. ChatGPT?
Mm-hmm. Right. So I think it's not even an argument that the traditional chatbot is quite annoying. The fact that you can't get to real people behind computer is quite annoying. The biggest difference between a traditional chatbot and ChatGPT or any large language model is essentially that interaction that you have. So the traditional chatbot is basically all programmed based on a preset of questions. So a lot of time they will give you a list of questions you can ask, and you just click through that, and they give you a pre-written answer for you. Whereas ChatGPT or any large language model use natural language processing, so actually understands the natural language that you put in there, and based on that, it can provide a more personalized response based on whatever information that, you know, the company that you're trying to interact with or the customer service you're trying to interact with. So that makes the response much more personalized, and it's overall a much more enjoyable process because there's less restriction, and it almost feels like you're talking with a real person behind the computer rather than a programmable chatbot.
So you're saying earlier some of the positive things you're seeing with this new technology is just like with these AI tools, is productivity improvements or?
Yeah, certainly. That's probably one of the biggest benefits right now because I think I'll just use ChatGPT as an example because everyone has experience with that. A lot of people have used ChatGPT to, for example, draft emails. So for drafting content, the biggest issue has always been coming up with that first draft. And if you have a tool like ChatGPT, you can easily just ask it to come up with your first draft and then start iterate from there, which makes your process a lot faster. Because coming up with that first draft always take, for me, at least 60-70% of time. Obviously, there are privacy considerations. For example, for a lot of workplace, you can really use that for your work because the confidential information, I think a while ago, Samsung had an incident and now they've banned ChatGPT within their company. But besides that context, for personal emails or just information that, you know, is publicly available, that's where you can really leverage a tool like ChatGPT to improve your productivity. And just besides ChatGPT, there are a lot of companies that are trying to make this enterprise at enterprise level, which means you can safely use your confidential data within your company and leverage the power of AI. So for example, Microsoft are coming up with Copilot, which is a really, really interesting product. It will help you to draft emails, draft documents, draft PowerPoints, help you to summarize video calls. If you're late for a video meeting, it will kind of tell you what you have missed. So really help you to increase your productivity at work in really all aspects.
Yeah, so that's on the positive aspect. So let's take a listen to the second clip, which is maybe goes into some of the negative sides. So basically, It's an episode, not episode, it's a clip of Geoffrey Hinton. He's known as the godfather of AI. He worked for many years at the University of Toronto on the underlying mathematical models that drive AI when the technology didn't actually exist yet. And he recently quit Google because of his concerns with the direction AI is taking. So let's quickly take a listen to that.
Well, eventually, if it gets to be much smarter than us, it'll be very good at manipulation because it will have learned that from us. And there are very few examples of a more intelligent thing being controlled by a less intelligent thing. And it knows how to program, so it'll figure out ways of getting around restrictions we put on it. It'll figure out ways of manipulating people to do what it wants.
So what do we do? Do we just need to pull the plug on it right now? Do we need to put in far more restrictions and backstops on this? How do we solve this problem?
It's not clear to me that we can solve this problem. I believe we should put a big effort into thinking about ways to solve the problem. I don't have a solution at present.
So yeah, that's Geoffrey Hinton. So what was your reaction to that?
It is 100% a concern, like what he said. That just says the importance of developing AI responsibly, because, like he said, this can be something that honestly much smarter than we are in terms of capability of processing information and also capability of finding information. So, for example, a lot of AI right now has access to internet and have access to a lot of data that as a human will be really, really, really hard or takes a really long time to process, digest, understand, and being able to, you know, use those information. But for AI, it takes a second. So for a technology that can learn so much faster than we are and come up with things so much faster than we are, obviously we need to be really careful. We do not want these technologies to go out of hand because effectively we're creating something that's smarter than us. And if our interest and whatever we're creating is like the interest between these two are not aligned, then obviously that's a bad news for us because how do we compete with a AI that just, you know, at a cognitive, in a intellectual aspect better than us? It'll be very difficult.
So what, you know, you talked about responsible practices, but how do you prevent, you know, other actors? Like what actually concretely do you think should be done?
Yeah, so that's a really good question. First of all, I think what OpenAI does or what a lot of other companies does, OpenAI does it less so right now because they're not really open source their model. But something that they did very well in this space is they give public access of ChatGPT, and they did it really successfully in terms of raising the awareness of the potential, I mean, good and bad, of AI. So at least now people are aware. That's step number one. You got to be aware of something before you start thinking about taking further action. Because everything that we're using, or majority of the things that we're using, for example, ChatGPT, is not new. ChatGPT launched, I think, in December of last year, but GPT-3 has came out for like way before that. And during that period, no one was really paying attention compared to the level of awareness that we have right now. So that's something that OpenAI did really well. And at the same time, because the fact that this is a software product, and in software space, open source is a way of involving a community of developers to really look through these applications and provide feedback to make sure that these applications are built in a way that is not malicious. So open source these models is another way that we can collectively make sure that these models are, you know, built in a way that's contributing to this field rather than in a way that, you know, going the opposite direction. So that's what a lot of companies are doing right now. They use some of the foundational models, and they train their own model. They open source the model. They open source the training data just so that the software development community can collectively, looking at this model, making sure we're going on the right path. So that's some of the concrete things people are doing right now to really make sure that, you know, we're not going down a path that's, we're developing something and that's something going to put us into a difficult position down the road.
So when you think about, you know, AI 10, 20 years from now, like, how do you feel about it? Do you feel like fear? Do you feel excitement? Like, what's your kind of emotion when you think about where AI is going? Because there's the, both the positive and the negative, but what's like the dominant emotion you feel right now? Mm-hmm.
The way I would describe it will probably be, I'm cautiously optimistic. Because think of a life cycle of any technology. There will be a spectrum. From the one end of the spectrum, that's where the cutting edge technology is. And from that point to the other end of the spectrum is where the application or commercialization of that technology is. So right now, the cutting edge research part for AI is leading the commercialization by a long way. So the reason I'm so optimistic is there are a lot of opportunities for business to adapt this technology so that it will make life easier in terms of people's daily process or just entire business efficiency, profitability overall, which is great for economy. Because at the end of the day, technology is the driver, in my opinion, of the economic growth in modern days. At the same time, I want to be cautious for the exact reason of, you know, the clip that you played. We always need to set up the safeguard for technology and particularly AI, because this is something that past certain point can start to develop a capability of self-training. So as we know, AI is trained by a large amount of data. And as we know, AI can write code for us. In fact, I use AI to write code.
So that's another thing I was wondering for you as well, Ash. Is AI changing your work in any way?
AI in general or ChatGPT?
AI in general, like is it impacting your work?
Yes, there is some research right now using AI to predict what the, you know, so the two most important quantities to produce a good coating on a part is the powder's temperature and its velocity. And to predict what the particle temperature and velocity is requires a huge amount of data and many different knobs that you can turn to affect that. And so through machine learning and through using AI, there is research being done in predicting the temperature and velocity of particles before impact. That cuts the cost and time required in developing a certain coating drastically.
Yeah, continue?
Yeah, no, exactly. So AI, no matter if it's classic AI or generative AI, classic AI, we've been using it for years. It's just that it is not super apparent on the day-to-day basis, not as much as generative AI. But yeah, that certainly will help us, you know, make our business process easier. I think what I was just saying is that we need to be cautious because AI, for example, can access to latest information on the internet, can access to or have learned how to write code. So if we get to the point that AI is starting to write code to get into that self-improvement cycle, that's where I think we really got to be cautious because that's where very quickly AI might be able to outsmart us.
It's scary to think about, at least for me. So last question. We've come to almost the end of the show. You know, both of you are, you know, graduates of the UBC Mechanical Engineering program. If you could go back in time and give some advice to yourself when you were starting out, what advice would either of you, I don't know who wants to go first, have given yourself?
I think of something, Ash. So if I were to go back to when I started university, what would I tell myself?
Yeah.
Join student teams. I think the things you learn in classrooms is the theoretical knowledge and the problem-solving skills still required, essential, necessary. But the hands-on learning aspect and working in teams is the thing that's what you get from student teams. And I would recommend that to anybody going into a mechanical engineering discipline.
Yeah, so I took a pretty drastic change on my career path after I graduated. Nothing that I do on a daily basis is related to mechanical engineering anymore. So if I were to, you know, just restart a university, I probably would tell like myself something like Ash said. Whatever you learn from class, it's important to build a foundation through that way, but it's not 100% applicable to the future work that we'll be doing. Because Ash is going down a technical path, so student team. If you're not going down a technical path, I think learning how to work with other people with different background, people with different skills, experience, and learn to understand how other people think, and just harness that different way of thinking together to achieve a common goal will be really important. And that can and that kind of practice can come in a lot of different forms. For example, student teams, or just student events, anything. Do as much of that as possible as you can outside of classroom.
Can I ask you a question, Arman, if we do have time? What would you say to yourself who's planning to go on a software development path?
Yeah, I think probably I would say, you know, chill out a bit, have more fun. I think, yeah, I took school very seriously in college. So, yeah, that's probably what I would tell myself. It's a good question. So thanks, everyone, for listening. And, thanks to Ash and Horace for making the time today. The music you heard is the song of the Mies. It was specially composed for us by a close friend of the show, the remarkably gifted Sarah Pratt. You can listen to more of her on SoundCloud at Leisure Noise. Few other things to wrap up. So you can find us at the Armand Akil on Instagram and Twitter. So do check us out there. We do have an awesome set of guests lined up for you. Do continue to listen and subscribe. You can find all of our episodes on our podcast feeds, including our recent interviews with City Councilor Christine Boyle and the historian Daniel Francis. So do check it out there. And yeah, thanks again, Ash and Horace.
Pleasure. Thank you.
Thank you for having us.
Thanks, everyone, and have an amazing Saturday night.